I had to be at a meeting until about 4:15, and luckily Google Maps told me to take the coast. and so I wasn't planning on that, but it took the meeting that I was just in, which my part of it didn't go so well, and every time I saw the water, it kind of washed it off of me. So that was really, really nice. And I'm probably going to fuss a bit with this robe because this is just our second date. And we don't know each other that well yet, and we're kind of fumbling around in the back seat here. So please, you know, if it falls off, I will work with it. This is a beautiful spot. I hadn't been down here before. And the light at this time of day is quite something. And this beautiful light colored floor. Is this bamboo floors? Yeah, these are really. And all your faces. So my intention tonight is to talk to you about nothing. Nothing as a transformational teaching that Zen offers us. Nothing as one of the three characteristics of existence as taught by the Buddha. So otherwise known, those three characteristics as suffering, impermanence, and emptiness. We experience suffering. And we're aware of impermanence. But what do we know about emptiness? In Buddhism, we talk about the two wings of the bird. Be careful with the robe. So wisdom and compassion. And the teachings about nothing fall into the realm of wisdom. This realization of emptiness is a wisdom understanding. Earlier this year, I listened to a Dharma talk by another Dharma brother, Jiryu, and he gave a talk at City Center about emptiness, which I thought was rather brave. And so I was encouraged by his willingness to try to open up the conversation about this very important aspect of our Zen teachings. And he talked about the potential of this teaching, which is to free us from everything. Makes it pretty worthwhile to try to study it, if it's going to free us from everything. From anxiety and fear and self-concern and everything. And he said, extreme times call for extreme teachings. So he was very brave, and that inspired me to give this a go. However, I remember our teacher, Reb Anderson, my first and maybe even second and maybe even third practice period at Tassajara, he insisted on teaching love. He taught love, and he taught it for a really long time. I think knowing or planning that he was going to move into this territory, which then he took us for 10 years by studying this very, very intricate sutra that taught about how to see and recognize emptiness. So on the way to these wisdom teachings, it's really, really important and helpful to spend a little time in the realm of compassion. Really, really warm up our hearts. So, right now, in our world, probably in this town, maybe even on this block, children are hungry. Gay men are being thrown off of rooftops. War is being waged. Injustice is everywhere. Can we allow ourselves to be intimate with this? Because that's what compassion actually is intimacy with all the things in this world that are from unpleasant to unbearable. Intimacy with that. So just take a moment right now. And can we allow some pain into our heart? Something maybe from what I just said, or something that you know, that you've seen, that you've heard about, and visualize it and take it in and send out our compassion to that being or that place or that part of the planet that you're holding right now. So just we're going to just do this for a minute. Take something that's painful and come close to it. Feel with it and want this being or this place to be relieved of suffering. Wish it well without needing it, without it wanting it to change at all yet. Just wish it well the way it is. Okay. Just a little warming up of the heart to remember why we're doing this. Why are we studying these difficult and sometimes confusing things? Why? To deepen our ability to be intimate with everyone. So this wheel of suffering and giving compassion, this round and round, it opens up our heart and makes us more pliable. And that activity that we just practice is actually what's happening. It's already happening. We just kind of made a picture or a story of it. We are constantly and without end creating and sustaining each other's lives. That's what's happening. And being aware of this round and round is an acknowledgement that we don't exist alone. We don't exist separately. We are constantly creating each other and being created by each other and being intimate with each other and feeling the pain and wishing the pain to be transformed. So when we participate in this activity of giving compassion, we're just enacting this truth of mutual creation. And giving compassion can be seen as a ceremony. So what we just did maybe was a little ceremony that exemplifies this kind of unknowable total interdependence of life. We use those words, life is completely interdependent. But our mind cannot actually know what that means. It's a signifier to say those words. And it heads us in a direction. It maybe helps us to ask questions about our assumptions. But we can't know it. It's unknowable. It's like our vows. They're undoable. This a teacher at Green Gulch, and I would tell you who it was, but I don't remember who said this. I just remember that in talking about this interdependence, this teacher said it was imperceptible mutual assistance. Does that sound familiar to you? Is that Linda Ruth? Or is that, I don't know who that is, but I'm sharing it with you because it meant a lot to me. Imperceptible mutual assistance. And this interdependence is an essential teaching of Zen. And in a way, that's the a positivistic, if there's such a word, way of talking about emptiness. And people, many people like to talk about emptiness in that way. Like it's how all things are creating each other. Steering clear of this kind of more erasing of your concept of separateness. So these are two different approaches. So what are we empty of? What is emptiness? It's emptiness of separateness. Emptiness of being isolated. Emptiness of permanence and unchangeable existence. And I've been using the word nothing today, nothing, which is, I would say that Zen gives us the gift of nothing. But this is a dangerous word, and I will try to be careful with it so as to not indicate that there is some kind of lack of a person, that there's nothing there, that you are not there. You're there. But not in the way you think you are, right? So that's the tricky thing about some of these words. It can lead us, approaching the emptiness teachings in the way I'm talking about can lead us to nihilism, which is a real no-no. That is not what we're talking about. So suffering is suffering, and if experienced directly, it's neutral. Impermanence can also seem like suffering when we resist it, but it's also the truth of the possibility of change and the possibility of waking up from our delusional attempts to resist change. It's a possibility in impermanence. This idea, however, of nothing, depending on how we hold it, can either scare us or calm us down. It can cause us to run around or to sit down for a while. It's difficult to approach this idea, this nothing, directly. So, as you know, in Zen there are wonderful stories called koans. And where often the experience of nothing, the realization of nothing through kind of experience, can be suspected and sometimes even felt ourselves as these stories are recounted and as we allow ourselves to be standing in the middle of the story. So I've chosen a couple of stories. I should pull my watch off just in case I get carried away here. I've chosen a couple of stories that involve a teacher asking for a gift. And maybe you'll notice as you think about each story as I present it, it may be very difficult for you to try to not make this something, this nothing, into something. So Bodhidharma, a very influential Zen ancestor, had a student named Weka. That's the guy who cut his arm off, if you know that story, to show his deep sincerity. So I don't know if this is before or after the arm, but he came to his teacher one day with this question. "My mind is restless," he said to Bodhidharma. "How can I set it at peace?" Boy, is that a question we all... Anybody, if this is your first time sitting Zazen today, or your 10,000th time sitting Zazen, you know what that question means. How can I set this mind at peace? So Bodhidharma says, "Bring me your mind and I'll put it at peace." This is a study of a lifetime. Bring me your mind and I'll put it at peace. This is Dogen's admonition or Dogen's instruction to study the self. Just look for it. Study the self. Where is the self? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's here. Oh, no, not there. Studying and studying and studying till you get into those subtle, subtle, subtle places where you're still deluded about being separate. You meaning me. Us. So, Weka says, but when I search for my mind, I do not find it. And in these koans, Reb brought this up once, we don't know how long it was between the first response and the second one. It could have been 15 years. He could have come back in 15 years and said, well, I searched. I can't find it. And Bodhidharma says, see, I already put it at peace. So, if it isn't there, and we make this really big effort to dislodge our delusion about being separate, we really make this effort, and we are given this kind of gift of it not being substantial, of it not being separate, there's peace there. Not permanent peace, but there is peace there. So, did Bodhidharma give his student the gift of nothing? And what is the gift of nothing? Today I say it's relationship. To participate in this nothing, to uncover this nothing, we need to cultivate a mind that can shed or drop off the greed and selfishness of the ego. And become aware of the harmony of all transactions. Giving is a very key way to practice this shedding of greed and selfishness and to celebrate the truth of relationship. Giving, receiving, giving, receiving. Story number two. Venerable Yang Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? So does he think he's bringing his teacher the gift of nothing? And does he think that there's something in addition to or after presenting nothing? Then what? I think he made a mistake. Zhao Zhou says, put it down. What was Yang Yang carrying? What are you carrying? So Yang Yang then said, well, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? And Zhao Zhou says, then carry it out. Pulling, I think this is true. At least I say it's true. Zen and what some of the important interactions between teacher and student is when the teacher pulls that rug out from underneath you. You're standing in one place and you think you're free and the teacher pulls the rug out and you realize there was a dependency there. You were relying on something. And when that's pulled away, then for that exchange, there's freedom. And it's scary sometimes, and it makes us anxious and frustrated and angry, and etc. But these stories have been going on for a very long time, because in these interchanges, in relationship, is where emptiness is understood. The introduction to this story is quite beautiful, the one about Yang Yang and Zhao Zhou. It says, playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know the voice is the root of the echo. If it's not riding an ox to look for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? When I sit in the middle of these koans, I watch myself go to this side to grab something and go to this side to grab something and then over here to grab something. And everywhere I go, the grabbing is necessary for then the releasing. Last story. Actually, second to last story. A university professor went to visit a famous Zen master. This is not a koan, this is a story. Well, it's sort of a koan. While the master quietly served tea, the professor was talking about Zen, I'm sure, trying to impress the teacher. The master poured the visitor's cup to the brim, and then he kept pouring. The professor watched the overflowing cup until he could no longer restrain himself. "It's overfilled. No more will go in," the professor blurts out. "You are like this cup," the master replied. "How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" So that's not easy. But that's the instruction. First, wash your bowl. First, empty your cup. If it's too full of your ideas, of my ideas, about who I am or what nothing is, or then there's no room for release. The gift of Zen is not about what we're going to get, but what we're going to lose. And when we lose everything that's extra, what's left is the complete fullness of being intimate with everything. Zen lessons have no answers, only the invitation to come closer, to bring our attention to the ever-present gift that's already there of intimacy and relationship, of imperceptible mutual assistance. In my life at Zen Center, I have appreciated the opportunity to study my selfish wish to be appreciated. When I was vice president of Zen Center, we raised a whole lot of money. I was president of Zen Center when we started to turn the corner on fiscal sustainability. Were those efforts freely given? Was that a gift or was it a manipulation? Doing giving is a power trip. Not doing it is love. And there is nothing to give that will create permanent appreciation, and nothing to get that will create permanent satisfaction. The giving of things or money or teachings is a gesture of acknowledging our relationship and inextricable intimacy. The connection between us is embodied in the form of a gift. It's the bridge over which the enactment of the exchange seems to occur, sort of like the flashlight that goes on what's already happening. Even though these stories of teacher and student seem to indicate the value of nothing, nothing does not stand alone as a thing. Nothing is the nothing of something. And something that is given with no expectations is the gift of nothing. When we give, we should not give something unless it has the qualities of nothing. give compassion with no expectation that it will alleviate suffering. That's manipulative giving. I'm going to do this so they'll stop crying, because it hurts me when they cry. Give each in-breath and out-breath to the benefit of the world. Don't give something unless there's nothing special about it. Nothing allows complete view of the other, and it upholds the relationship overall. Dongshan was conducting a memorial service for his teacher, Yunyan, and a monk asked him, "What instruction did you receive at your late teacher's hand?" Dongshan said, "Although I was there, I didn't receive his instruction." The monk said, "Well then, why conduct a service for him?" Very practical monk. And Dongshan said, "I do not esteem my late teacher's virtues or his Buddhist teachings. I only value the fact that he gave me nothing." Now, I don't know if he knew he was going to be placed in the middle of this talk, if he meant that kind of nothing we've been talking about, but I think he did. Because he didn't get zero from his teacher. He got the gift of nothing from his teacher, which is worth conducting a service for. So I celebrate this relationship in which we hold each other up and mutually create the world, which is empty of permanent, unchangeable things and full of mutable, vibrant, shining relational life. And I encourage you to consider the value of the gift of nothing that your teachers do their best to offer you. So in conclusion, after I started to put this talk together, I came across a book. And the book is called The Gift of Nothing. And I'm going to read it to you. It's a children's book. I'll show you the pictures too, okay? It was a special day, sort of like today. And Mooch, over here, he's kind of a cat, wanted to give his best friend, Earl, who's kind of a dog, a gift. But what to get him? He had a bowl, very nice bowl. He had a bed. He had a chewy toy that squeaked. He had it all. So Mooch thought and thought, what do you get someone who has everything? Oops, sorry. He's thinking, and he goes, nothing. He would give Earl the gift of nothing. But in this world filled with so many somethings, where would he find nothing? Mooch often heard Frank, and Frank must be his human, say, there was nothing on TV. But as far as Mooch could tell, there was always something on TV. Blah, 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 blah. Mooch often heard Doozy and her friends say, there was nothing to do. But as far as Mooch could tell, everyone was always doing something. Millie came home from the store and said, there was nothing to buy. So Mooch went shopping. So he's looking and he's looking. There are sales. There are lots. It's like going to some big place. Mooch looked up and down every aisle. He found many, many, many somethings. The latest this, the newest that. He was probably getting a headache. I know I do. But as far as he could tell, nothing was not for sale. So Mooch went home. And what did he do? He sat on his pillow. He sat on his pillow and just stayed still, as cats often do. And not looking for it, he found nothing. And he's purring over here, so it was a pretty peaceful sit for him. So he went and got a box, and he put nothing in it. Then Mooch thought, maybe Earl deserves more than this. So he got a bigger box. Now that's plenty of nothing. So he brings it over to his friend Earl's house. For me, says Earl, Mooch, you didn't have to give me anything. Who told him, thought Mooch. Earl opened Mooch's gift. There's nothing there, said Earl. Yes, said Mooch. Nothing. But me and you. So Mooch and Earl just stayed still and enjoyed nothing. And everything. The end. So, we have a few minutes. If you wanted to bring up something or nothing or questions or statements or, yes.
So if the ultimate goal in life is to sort of detach yourself from the impermanent reality to essentially achieve nirvana, and yet here you are saying that we are very interconnected, and thus how does that paradoxic duality work when we're supposed to be detached yet attached at the same time?
So I'm going to focus on part of what you just said, which is something like the goal of our life is to detach from impermanent reality, something like that? Mm. Something like that? We're already detached.
Oh.
So impermanence is happening, and we have this idea that we can kind of try to hold it, but that's not real.
Right.
Right. So, and what is real, on the other hand, is that we are mutually creating each other.
Right.
So I would say maybe the goal of our life is to realize what's actually going on, not to create something new that doesn't already exist, which is a lot of hard work and probably impossible.
Right.
Does that help?
It does help, considering my ambitions.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to be enlightened too.
All right.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that would be good, huh? Yeah. Wonder what that means to you, though. I mean, I think it probably means something different to each person in this room, being enlightened.
Right.
So watch out for something that takes the wrong kind of effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes an effort to wake up to what's actually there, but it's not about creating something that you have
to... Discovering what's already there.
Correct. Correct. And the effort to discover that is so much about relaxation. It's so much about relaxing into it and not trying to get away from it.
So embracing the unknown, essentially.
That's a big part of it, yes. Yes. It takes courage. It takes courage, and it can be scary. But the key is to kind of give up, make the effort to give up the wrong kind of effort. How are you, Liz? Liz is an old friend that I haven't seen in a really long time.
I'm just thinking it's lovely expression of just core reminders of the teachings. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Liz taught me to order food in season. I was the Tanzhoe Green Gulch, and she was the head of the farm, and I was fairly ignorant, and I liked what I liked. I wanted to go and buy berries in the middle of winter, and she helped me discipline my tastes. Yes.
King Kadabi talk, he said something about if suffering is met directly, it is neutral, something like that. And I know that's not the central part of your talk, but it just captures it as a sentence. Could you say a little bit more?
I knew that would get somebody. I was actually in a study session this weekend where one of the students in the session was talking about pain and how it's not possible to be neutral in the midst of pain. And I think it is. Because if you study, if you use, for instance, pain in your knee when you're sitting, one can notice that any movement whatsoever increases the pain. From physical movement to actually the mind moving will increase because it'll go to thinking about whether it's going to last or is it hurting me. The mind moves off of just the awareness of the suffering or the pain. And then you're in resistance and then it's not neutral. But it is possible to just completely meet it. And it can be unpleasant, but so what? You know, we were not promised a rose garden, right? It's gonna hurt. Things are gonna hurt. To be angry that it hurts, to wish it didn't hurt, all of that is extra and suffering. But to just meet something unpleasant, something again from the, on the spectrum from, you know, unpleasant to unthinkable in a just a complete way, in that moment, you're free. You're free of your ideas about it. And that's where the suffering comes from, is our ideas about it. Do you want to say more? Does that answer?
That has been my experience, and I've been able to do that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. Good.
I have a comment, which is just, I think when it's really hard to recognize that the cup is full is exactly in relationship. It's harder for me to accept difficulties in relationship and not think it should be otherwise. So I'm thinking about like, well, we got to fix this. We got to make this go away. We got to change this. So then it's hard to practice with the truth of the mutual interconnectedness.
Right.
But it's great to have pointers, you know, and reminders and inspiration.
Yeah, we all get stuck, and I was really stuck in that board meeting where I did a terrible job and wasted the board's time before I came down here. And if I hadn't had the ocean, you know, to kind of rinse me out when I kept seeing it, you know, over on the side. It would have been harder to give the talk tonight. You know, I was pretty involved with the fact that I had lost face. You know, I had not been as smart as I'm supposed to be. That was hard. Yes.
I'm just delighted that you brought that children. I've spent a number of years, like about 15, working in early childhood education. And I think it's a potent tool to have the Dharma contained children's school. As you said, it's so important to just relax.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Not
yes. 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 Yeah, it's a delightful book. I mean, some of the reviews in it recognize that it does have certain Zen tendencies, so. Yeah. Yeah, but you can sneak it, you know, if you've got a nephew or something, that sneak them this book. Good. Thank you. Well, maybe. Unless there's one more question. Oh, yes, hi.
So, as you were talking, I was thinking of the Zen formulation of no giver, no receiver, and no gift. And having experienced that sometimes, when that's happening, it's hard to talk about. One can't really say something arises, but one really can't say that nothing arises.
That's right.
Either. What is it that arises?
Imperceptible mutual assistance.
Yeah.
Imperceptible. We can't, the minute we name it, we kill it. You know, we limit it to a thing. But it's a process. So it's fleeting. It's not something we can hold on to. But you know, perhaps in our bodies, there's a lightness and awareness, a freedom, a sense. In these koans, what is it that happens when the student and teacher wake each other up? You know, you can't name it. They bow. Basically, they bow. So bowing helps, but naming it doesn't. Yeah. So maybe. Maybe that's it. And thank you for letting me explore this with you. It's a lifetime exploration. And please forgive me if I said anything that might lead you astray. And thank you for your attention. And now we chant. Beings are